people to do interviews.
And we're going to try to.
Well, I guess I'll just hold it up here. There's a lot of questions I want to ask you, but I think maybe we'll just start with some favorite memories of Glenville and what it's meant to you over the years.
Well, I guess, you know, I came here as a student in 1961 and started college. Didn't even know about the book festival when I came here. And I came here as a student, and soon after I got here, I met Fern Rollison, who was then president of the festival. And she heard I played guitar and sang, and got acquainted with her, and she sort of just kind of started pulling me in. And I guess one of my early favorite memories is the first time I played on the program. At that time, the program was up at the gymnasium, and the audience sat in the bleachers, and it was a terrible place to sing. It was terrible. And hot in there, I remember, just terribly, terribly hot. But I was just thrilled to death to get to play up there after I found out what was going on. And I remember singing Barbara Allen, and I remember I got a good response, and you know, just real happy about it. Mm-hmm. And then that's where I sort of got hooked on the folk festival right there. And at that time, Byron Turner, I don't know if you've run into that name or not, he was in before I got acquainted with him. So that's one of my early favorite memories, the first memory really, and favorite memory of the folk festival right there.
Go ahead and check it. Testing 1, 2. So you got involved in 1961 then?
Well, actually, I didn't get involved until, to mount anything, until about 63 or 64.
Okay.
As I told you, I did that night program up there and just sang one song.
Okay.
And got acquainted with Fern, and Fern lives right over the hill here. We're talking, and she started having me down every now and then for tea, and we just talk about the festival. And she wanted somebody to do the master ceremonies work and give Byron Turner a little relief because he was doing it all.
Mm-hmm.
And she sort of talked me into that. So one of the first things I started doing around here as far as festival was concerned was doing the master ceremonies work at the fiddle and banjo contest.
Mm-hmm.
And Byron usually did the night programs, and I just do the afternoon contest. Me and a guy named Jim Bush, I don't know if you
remember. Yeah, I remember Jim. Yeah.
He used to help me do that. And we did that probably for, I don't know how many years. We ran the fiddle and banjo contest here, Jim and I did. And then I would do a spot on a night program most of the time, a song or two. And then I started kind of getting interested in the square dancing down there. And Tom Luzader and Willie Reed at that time were running the dance floor. They didn't really teach me. I just watched them and learned squares and learned how to call. So I started doing a little bit of that. So, you know, I just sort of gradually got involved in all of it. And of course, I left Glenville in 64 and went out in the world there for about 10 years. But I came back to festival every year and still did a lot of the MC work. And then when I came back in 73 to work here at the college, that's when I started really getting involved in the organization and all that kind of stuff. But during the 60s there, I just pretty much played a little bit on the program and did some MC work and did pretty much what Fern told me to do. Whatever she needed done, I tried to help her do it. So that's sort of how I got started out.
Well, as far as the earlier history of the festival, I mean, from what I know, and I know pretty limited amount, Dr. Gaynor was the principal one who started it in the summer of 1950. Were there other people involved at that point? I mean, was Dr. Byron Turner involved at that point?
Most of the involvement of the people who were later involved resulted from Dr. Gaynor's departure. He started the festival, and the festival is definitely his legacy. It's his idea. He started the festival. And at the time, it originated in a class he was holding, an agriculture class, and it sort of spilled over into town. At the time, it was pretty much his show. And as you've probably heard, he got upset with the town. They didn't want to do the way he wanted it done. And so he just pretty much tried to take the festival to Beckley and leave Glenville with it. But Byron Turner and some other people sort of picked it up when he left there. And I think that's how Byron got kind of started it. He was sort of trying to carry on what Pat started. And then Mrs. Ronaldson got in and sort of became the leader of the whole event there for many, many years. But Byron, I think, was sort of trying to keep Pat's ideas going. And I give Byron a lot of credit for keeping it on the right track during the early times. But, you know, with anything like this, even today, it's really hard to keep out the what we call commercial music element. People who are trying to get ahead in country music or bluegrass or whatever. And Byron and Fern were very good on trying to keep the right things, the kind of things Dr. Green wanted to do. And that's feature real, true, native West Virginia musicians who didn't play music for a living and never intended to play music for a living, but just, you know, played this as a part of their lives. And he wanted to bring them in and show them off the world. That was his whole philosophy, to show the people that, you know, West Virginians could do something besides be ignorant hillbillies. That's his line, not mine. That's what he always said. And I think Fern and Dr. Turner did a very good job of keeping his ideas intact, and at the same time liberalizing the festival a little bit from his original intent. He was very, very much a purist, Dr. Gainer was, and he liked a cappella singing, and he liked individual performers. He liked a guy playing the fiddle by himself and that sort of thing. Wasn't much of a band guy, and he wasn't much of a square dance guy. Very distinguished guy. You probably never met him, did you?
No, I never met him.
But he was a very distinguished guy, PhD in literature and all that. But a guy who did a lot of good work on gathering songs and bringing them in here, and probably because of him, a lot of these songs hung around that wouldn't hung around. So
yeah.
I had a lot of respect for him, but he was just different from what we normally think of a traditional musician being. He's a little more dignified with it than most of us are, I guess.
A little bit more scholarly.
More scholarly, that's a better word for it.
Yeah.
To me, you know, the music to me is to be enjoyed, and I've never been much of a preservationist myself. I just like to play it, and if it gets preserved, well, that's fine. You know, that's sort of what it's been to me. And I think he took a lot more scholarly approach to it.
And now, The one thing that's always impressed me, I came the first time in 1974, I guess, and have been here most years since then, except for a period during the 80s and the early 90s where I wasn't here, but the fact that this is a community festival and that the people here in the town put their time and effort into making sure that this thing happens. And everybody's a volunteer, correct?
Right. Nobody ever gets paid. In fact, I laughed last night. I came here to play last night with my brothers, and Jim Summers gave me $50, and I said, it's the only time I ever got any money at the folk fest. It's the only time I ever got paid for anything. Because, as you said, it's all volunteer, and there's a committee in town, a folk festival committee, which consists of some people from the college, some people from the town, just anybody who wants to help, and they have a board of directors. But during the years when I was president and the years I was working with the festival, community support was always just wonderful, and there's always somebody there to do what needed to be done, willing to work all kind of hours to do it. Somebody do the spelling bee and somebody do the parade and all that, and it's all volunteer, and everybody had the right idea about what the festival should be, and everybody had this, I mean, the word was always traditional, let's keep it traditional, keep it traditional. I always had a lot of respect for the town for doing that. And as you say, nobody got paid for it. It wasn't a money-making event. And one of the things, are you familiar with the Elder Hostel program that they used to come in here every year? And I did an Appalachian culture class with them. And that's the thing that always impressed those out-of-state people, that there wasn't anybody, the purpose wasn't to make money. You know, there was no money involved, really.
Yeah.
And they were amazed at this fiddle contest, which gives nothing but a ribbon, but everybody just wants to win so bad, you know, just because of it. It's Glenville, it's because it's tradition. So I really think that's the great thing about the Folk Festival. It's a non-commercial event, and people come here and play, come because they want to play, and nobody's trying to be a star, nobody's trying to make money, and I think that's one of the great things about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I did want to ask you a little bit about the dance and the square dance, and I know that you just call local or regional squares.
Right.
And
one of the things I noticed when I started going down the Square Dash platform, and of course that came along later too, after Dr. Gaynor and the Square Dash platform. I'm not sure what year that started, but in the 60s sometime when they started doing that platform. But one of the things I noticed was very early on when they called the squares, there was just six or eight squares that they called. And if someone, an outside person, would want to call something different, you know, they didn't want anything to do with it. I've seen people just walk off the floor and say, you know, that's not something we do. And I think the West Virginia State Folk Festival here in Glenville is probably the only reason that those old traditional squares that came out of Central West Virginia still survive. And they still, I danced down there last night, they still call the same old squares, still do them the same way. And I just think that's a wonderful thing. And if you've noticed, it's all four couple sets, no big circle stuff, no fancy Western squares. This is very basic, simple square dancing that has been done in these hills probably since, you know, people settled here first. And I don't know if you're familiar with this book. Bob Dousmer, are you familiar with the book he wrote called West Virginia Square Dancing?
No.
Okay. Bob was a faithful festival goer back there in the 60s and 70s. I think he's from Maryland. But he came into West Virginia and wrote a book about square dancing. And he said, he made that remark, that the folk festival was amazing because they clung to the old squares and refused to change to the more modern type square dancing. And he's exactly right, you know, they have. And if you go four or five counties away, you'll see a lot of different things being done. But they've stayed right with it here. And I think, again, I think it's a non-commercial thing. People, they come to dance, they don't want to learn anything. They just come to dance what they know how to dance. To me, that's sort of become, in the 70s, the square dance platform becomes sort of the centerpiece of the festival. That's where all the activity was going on at night. And it sort of became a lot bigger thing probably than Dr. Gaynor would have wanted it to be. And that's one of the things I think has changed.
Yeah, I seem to recall in 1976, the year of the bicentennial was huge down there.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, almost to the point that it was outrunning the available facilities.
Right. It was out of control. Probably 75, 6, 7, and 8, those years right in there, the festival just about got out of control. In fact, the town got upset with us, the festival committee, because we were bringing in too many people. And they kept telling us, you got to cut the size of the crowd down, and that's just something you can't already do.
Yeah.
You just can't tell people not to come. That's what I used to say. But at that time, as you well know, there was a huge throng of people in America just running the festival circuit.
Right.
You know, Union Grove, Galax, Glumble,
right,
wherever they could find that this kind of music was being played. And it was just almost like a traveling circus that went from festival to festival, sort of was. And a lot of them were what local people considered not respectable people, you know?
Yeah.
And so we went through some years there when there was some fear that the festival was going to be stopped. And that's one of the things I was hearing when I first became president. You know, you can't keep doing this because the town can't handle it. And that era there just sort of fizzled out, you know, on its own. And the festival now is about like it was probably in the 60s. The crowd size and what goes on there is about the same. So that was just sort of a thing that happened that, where everybody, it was sort of a fad and a craze, and it just sort of fizzled out. So I don't think any permanent harm was done, but you know, it destroyed Union Grove. They stopped having that festival because they got out of control. And it very nearly destroyed this one. But there were some good things about that. You know, it was an exciting time.
Yeah.
You know, some great picking sessions, and people stayed up all night, and it was some good times.
One of the things that I guess I've noticed, anyone has noticed who's been around, is the fact that every year there's fewer and fewer of the older musicians. And we just lost Wilson here this year. Does it concern you that, I mean, even though there's a lot of younger people that have learned tunes from Wilson and from some of the others, that at some point maybe the thing will just change beyond recognition?
I think it's inevitable, I really do. It's going to change beyond recognition. And to me, you know, I'm not in the mainstream of thought on this maybe, but to me, what it is education. You know, we've all been corrupted by education, all of us who play music now. And that old bunch of musicians that came in here year after year, and I can name you names, Noah Cockrell, Lee Triplett, Ira Mullins, and Genus Cockrell, and Doc White, and French Carpenter, and all those guys were uneducated, rural people, you know. And they played music, and I thought it was remarkable how well they played. They had no training. They didn't get to hear recorded music when they were growing up. And, you know, there's just nobody. You can't replace that because we're not that way anymore. And we've all been, I don't care how much we say we're not, we're all influenced by modern music, you know, because you hear it. I know my dad used to tell me, watching me learn to play a fiddle tune with a tape recorder and backing the tape up and trying to learn something, he used to say, I wish I'd had that when I was learning. You know? He said, that would have been a nice thing to have. He said, the only way I could hear it was just somebody playing it in front of me, you know, and I could stop him and make him play it again. But, you know, there's no doubt that's had a tremendous influence on the way we all play. And to get back to your point there, you know, there's no way that the festival's ever going to be like it was, because even though we play the same tunes and even though we're not commercial musicians, we're still, as I say, we've been corrupted. You know, our values have been corrupted by education and by the music that we've heard. And if you're any kind of musician at all, you're going to be influenced by what you hear around you. I don't care who you are. And it's just like my younger brothers and me. You know, they come out of, they're about 10 years younger than me. And we almost have a generation gap in their music, you know, the way we play. And we've sort of been able to merge that. But you know, a lot of people think we're too slick to be traditional musicians, and we probably are because of all that influence. But you know, there's no way that you're going to replace Wilson Douglas and Ira Mullins and Lee Triplett and all those guys. There's just no way you're going to, because the culture's changed.
Yeah.
And the festival's not going to ever be the same because of that. To me, you know, the exciting thing to me when I was president here for all those years is when those guys came to town, and I see Noah Cotter coming to town, and I see Lee and Ira coming to town, and to me, that's what it was all about. You know, those guys came in here, and
yeah,
they were very competitive, you know, I just loved to get them in here and listen to them play, and you know, half of it was their personality, you know, and we just lost that, and there's nothing you can do about it. Closest thing to it probably we have John Morris.
Yeah.
He probably is.
Yeah.
Closest thing we have to it.
Well, and you know, things have changed a lot over the years, and by gosh, 50 years are going to change.
Oh yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And I know that, you know, you can point to any number of things from the box elder tree downtown to, you know, the auditorium up here, but
yeah,
I still, you know, my personal feeling is that it's still a very, very good thing.
Oh yeah. To me, it's the thing, you know, for our traditional music, and still is, just like it always was. But we're just going to have to face the fact that it's going to be different. But as long as we cling to the traditional music and keep the commercialism out of it and keep the dancers from wearing fancy clothes and all that sort of thing, I think, you know, we're on the right track, and that's what it's all about. And, you know, I've played a lot of places in the past 35, 40 years, my brothers and I, but some of the best picket sessions I've ever been in anywhere is right here in this town. There's no doubt in my mind about it. It's been a few years ago, but they were here, and a lot of good things happen here still every year. So I'm just honored to have been a part of it. As I told you, I just sort of fell into it, you know, with coming here. But I've been honored to be a part of it. I really have.
Are there some other people that you can think of that have made significant contributions? You know, you mentioned Tom, you mentioned Fern Rollison, Dr. Byron Turner.
Right. And there's some people that have sort of been always behind the scenes who did a lot of things that no one even knew about. And a guy that I just talked to downtown a minute ago, Ansel Cutler. Ansel used to be almost the main cog in that country store down there. And the country store is, at one time, that was the only financial support the festival had. It was a profit made in the country store. Back in the days before grants, that's the only money they had. And Ansel was the guy behind that all the time. And he had a crew of people who helped him. I can't think of hardly any of their names right now. I remember a lady named Mrs. Reed who worked in there all the time. And those people were totally unsung. Nobody even knew they were there when the festival was going on. But without them, you know, the festival couldn't have gone on. So I think of them all the time. And There's another lady here who taught in the chemistry department for many years named Mary Jo Pribble, who was not a musician, not a crass person, or not anything, but she loved the festival and she gave countless hours to it. And there's a lot of that. I can't call a lot of the names for you, but there's a lot of that goes on, I suppose, with any event. Some people are out there in front getting the publicity and the credit and everything, but there's a lot of people behind the scenes doing a heck of a lot of stuff. And Tom Luzader, as you mentioned there, was one of the hardest working guys in the festival, for whatever you wanted done. And Dr. Turner and his wife, Elizabeth, they were also sort of secret financial supporters. You ever got in a financial bind, they'd bail you out, you know. And it's things like that people don't know about, and that I think are really important that people do know about. And we're talking about the history of the festival.
Festivals never taken any kind of federal money.
Right? No, we got started when I was first came here. We started getting that little state grant from Arts and Humanities, and I was on the Arts and Humanities committee at the time, and so I had a little inside track there, and I started getting a little bit of money from the festival, and that's the first time we started paying anybody gas money. And as you well know, you know, that all anybody still gets here is just gas money, you know, enough to get through the weekend. But for many, many years, there was no money for even anybody. And when we started getting that little grant, we started playing the old folks that came, and so they'd have a place to stay. Because people came slipping their cars, and you know, it was awful the way people had to do. And Woody Simmons, who I know you know well, he told me he used to come in here on Friday night, play at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and drive back to Elkins, and go to work, and then come back Saturday night. You know, that's how much people loved it, you know. And so we started getting that little state grant, and it got a little bigger. I don't know how much it is now, but we got enough to pay everybody in their expenses, the performers, and some of the craft demonstrators. And as you said, we've never taken any big federal money, and it's still not a big, there's still not much money involved with it at all. But it's kind of nice to get gas money and meat money to come and play. And I tell you, another war that's going on in the festival that very few people know about. It's kind of an interesting little thing, but there's. When this festival, when Dr. Gaynor started, it was pretty much music. I mean, that was the thing he was interested in. Yeah. And demonstrating people who could play a dulcimer, demonstrating somebody. It was more of a demonstration than a show, what he did. Somebody could play the fiddle, somebody could play the lap dulcimer, somebody could sing the old songs. And a lot of people wanted to come in to sell crafts. And he fought that war, and I think that's one reason he left. You know, he did not want to get into that. Well, Mrs. Rollison didn't want to get into it either, and so she sort of compromised, said, okay, we'll bring in some demonstrators. We'll bring a blacksmith, let him demonstrate how to do it, be a blacksmith, and we'll bring in a quilter and let her show how to quilt, but nobody's going to sell anything. And she said, we're not here to make money. So I sat and listened to her talk about that. So when I became president, I stayed right with that. I tried to. But the pressure got intensive to have selling craftspeople. And the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years that I was here, I kind of broke down a little bit and started letting some in. As I see now, we had a pretty good volume down there. But it was originally a music and dance festival. And there has been, since I can remember, that war has been going on. You know, people want to set up craft booths. And there's something to be said for that, because it brings more people in, for one thing. And but it's the fear of the old folks, Pat and Fern, was that not to make it a commercial thing. That was their whole fear. So that's a little inside war that went on for a long time and nobody even knew about, probably. And I took a lot of heat over when I was president. I all kind of heat over it, because I didn't want crafters to come in. But I think it's worked out okay. It's still not a big commercial event.
No.
You know, it's not a Jackson's Mill or a Cedar Lakes or something, which is what everybody feared. And I don't think that's happened.
Well, that's one of the things when I started looking at this, I realized that the only reason I ever came to Glenville was for the music.
Yeah.
And when I started talking to John about writing this article, he said, well, you know, you need to cover more than just the music.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to make a real effort this weekend to go out and look and see the other things that are going on. But I still feel like that's the primary reason why people are here.
Yeah, it is.
The other things are nice, but...
Yeah, and I hope we never lose that. You know, I hope the music stays in focus. Another thing used to go on here that kind of fiddled out was the Horse Breeders Union. I don't know if you ever noticed that or not, but people would bring horses in here and whip sycamore down here, and they'd trade a big field up there. And that was a pretty big event until probably early 70s, probably started fizzling out. And it was always high excitement when they come in, because they call these people gypsies. I don't know who they were. But they said the gypsies come in with these horses, and they'd paint them, and they'd do everything, and they'd try to cheat people. And big thing up there. And I used to go up every Saturday and Dream Festival week and watch a little bit of it. So those are some of those little things that wasn't music generated some interest there for a while. And the dancing, I want to say something about this a minute ago. I don't know if you've seen the pictures in the old papers, but they used to dance on the lawn there on the campus when Dr. Gaynor did this, and they did those dignified minuet type dances, you know, everybody wearing long dresses and that kind of thing. And that's what he thought dancing was all about. But that was his, you know, his focus was music and dancing, traditional dancing and music. And I'm not sure, I don't know whose idea it was to build that platform down, I don't know where that came from, but just sort of that transition took place, and more emphasis got placed on dancing for a lot of years there.
Yeah. I remember seeing a video that had been shot here, it must have been in the early days, and I don't know if you haven't seen it, but somebody had it one year at Morgantown when they were having a benefit concert for the collection up there, the Chappelle collection. They showed a short video of Glenville, and it must have been from the late, mid-50s or something like that. And it wasn't very long, it was in black and white, but I remember seeing some dancing on it that looked almost like, I don't know, Morris dancing or something like that.
Yeah, it's kind of like that. That Morris Contra
something Morris like that.
I never saw any of that done. It had stopped before I got here, but I saw pictures of it, and I heard Fern talk about it. Mm-hmm. And it was done up on Brunham Maple Lawn up on the campus. And that must have stopped in the late 50s, because, as I said, I got here in 61, and I never saw that kind of thing going on. And when I came, the square dance platform, that's where the fiddle contest was. They just get up on the platform there and play.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And just about everything went on there. And then at night, they went up in the college gym and did the formal program. And Pat, I guess he wasn't too big keen on contest either, from what I hear. I don't know that for sure. That's what I heard. That's probably after he left, sort of. But Pat was a pretty scholarly guy, and when I came back here in 73, he was retired, living down at Tanner, which is 6 miles from here. And I brought him in as a guest speaker a couple of times for my Appalachian culture class, and I was kind of stunned at his approach even then. You know, he was very scholarly, and he was not at all happy about these hot bands that come together here and these hot picket sessions. That wasn't his thing at all. I was kind of surprised at that. And that's when I really got to know him, was when he came to those classes. And he always wore a tie and was very dignified.
Mm-hmm. Well, even in the mid-70s, didn't he help to teach a class for college credit?
Yeah, I think he did.
Frank George was involved.
Yeah.
A few other people.
We did, when I first came here, we started an Appalachian culture class in the summertime that ran in conjunction with the folk festival. If you wanted to take the class, you come in on Monday and stayed all week, and we had some classes, and Pat taught some of those classes, and Frank taught some of them. And then it sort of merged into the festival at the end of the week. Then we changed that into an elder hostel program and started getting people here from all over the country, about 50 of them every summer that would come in for festival week. And Pat did a couple of those. And he did a very good job. You know, I really appreciated what he did. He was a little different from the rest of us, that's all.
So I don't want to keep you too much longer. Okay. I appreciate your time, but you think we'll be here in another 50?
Well, I think somebody will. not me and you.
Maybe not us.
probably, it's hard to predict something like that. But there's interest in it among young people, and I think there's always going to be fiddlers. And, I got a daughter, 30 years old, who plays the old fiddle things. She doesn't travel festival circuit, but she plays and knows the tunes, and I'm sure she's one in 100 that does that. So I think they'll be around. Galax has been going on since 26, I think it is, and it's still hanging in there. So I think it'll survive. I don't know. You know, we have an economic thing happening in this county with this prison coming in. I don't know what that's going to do to the town. Maybe nothing. I don't know. But you know, if the town gets, you know, the typical American commercial strip with McDonald's and Hardee's and hotels and all that, I don't know what that would do to a place like this. But part of the quaintness of this festival is the town itself.
Yeah.
And,
that's true.
If you lose that, why? It's the only festival I know that happens in town. You know, you go out to Union Grove, Galax, and wherever you go, Alabama, or whatever. And then we've been to 100 of them, my brothers and I. We're usually out in a big field somewhere or in a college auditorium or something.
Yeah.
But, you know, this one just happens all over town. And I think it's one of the great things about it, one of the unique things about it. And it's also spontaneous. My philosophy used to be, and I'm not sure if it's the right philosophy, but I didn't believe in workshops or organized events. I believe in getting everybody in town and let them find each other and play. That's what I wanted to do. And they pretty much did. And keep it as informal as possible and just let everybody enjoy the music. And they still pretty much do that, although I noticed they formalized a few things here now. And I even taught a square dance workshop last night, which I know they do. And they had a fiddle workshop, I think, today in banjo. And those things were fine. But you know, to me, and things have changed. People, if it used to be, those old guys come into town, you didn't have to tell them to get together at 4 o'clock and play, because they'd find each other and play wherever it was. So that was a great thing about it. And I don't know if you remember or not, it used to be the night program wasn't structured at all. It'd just be a bunch of people out back, and I'd go out and get somebody and say, come in and play.
I do remember that.
You remember that?
Because that parking lot behind the auditorium was some of the best music happened right back there.
And we lost some when we moved down the hill. You know, we really did.
Yeah.
But it was a horrible experience if you're the MC, because you were never sure who your next act was. But it was a great thing to do, you know. Come on out and play a couple of things, you know. And the band would form right out there, you know, that had never been formed before.
Yeah.
In fact, I don't know if you've heard my brothers and I do this troubadour song. But that's where that song came together, right behind that auditorium one night. We were throwing all these things into it.
Yeah.
And that's where it happened right there. And a lot of good things happened there.
Well,
we moved down the hill, and of course everybody just kind of stands back there in air conditioning now, and nothing happens.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's always trade-offs. It's comfortable for the people who come to see the concerts, but
you lose some.
Yeah.
Now, one more thing I want to mention.
Yeah.
One of the other things that used to happen here, and I'm not sure when it stopped, was the old round robin. Late night round robin. In fact, I guess the first year I played, or second year I played, everybody went to the Presbyterian Church after the program was over, up in the gym or later in the auditorium. And we just got in a big circle in the basement, and everybody did a song. You know, and you'd get the next guy to do a song, and we'd do that till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. Now that was a good thing.
Yeah.
And I don't know why it stopped, but it did, because, as you well know, the people who enjoy the music the most are the musicians.
Mm-hmm.
They enjoy each other. And I don't know when that stopped, but somewhere or another it did. But you know, Pat was always opposed to bringing in big name, even big name folk musicians. They talked about bringing Burl Ives in one time. I understand he was through a fit; he wouldn't have it. I wouldn't hear of him, but I've read about that. And I guess about the only guy who ever came in here who was nationally known was Mark Moore. Have you ever heard that name?
Yeah.
He came in for 3 or 4 years, and he was kind of a nationally known folk singer. But he blended very well, and he didn't try to push, and Fern loved him, you know. And she just fell in love with him. And other than that, it's pretty much local boys. And of course, the Red Clay Ramblers used to come through, but I mean, they just come in and played like everybody else, you know. They were fine.
When you were talking about that a minute ago, I used to come and sit with a little tape recorder and tape some of the shows in the auditorium.
Oh, yeah?
And I have a tape I ran across. In fact, I gave Bill Hicks a copy of it, that Jim Watson, and Tommy Thompson, and Bill Hicks, and Ira Mullins. And Ira was singing with them.
Oh, that right?
They were doing an old gospel song, something about Where Shall I Be, I think it was.
Yeah.
But, you know, stuff like that, I mean, that's kind of a once-in-a-lifetime thing.
Yeah. Sure is. And that happened there a lot.
Yeah.
It happened a lot. And we, and you know, one of the things about Glenport that's unique, and as I said, I've traveled a lot of festivals, is how people mix in and out of
from different bands, you know, and everybody loves to do it. But you go a little further south, and they don't like that. You know, they've got their little act together, and they don't want you horned in on them. And that's one of the great things about doing that.
Yeah, I feel like people are very open.
Oh, yeah.
They don't seem to keep, you know, anybody out. Anybody who wants to come up and join in.
Yeah, many is the time that Ted and Roger, my brothers and I, would be out back there getting ready to go in and play, and somebody's like Joe Dobb or somebody step in and play with us. We'd say, come on out and play with us. And everybody was that way. And I think the audience particularly enjoy that.
Mm-hmm.
They just spontaneity like that. Yeah. It's a really good thing. But those are some good memories. And I think we've lost a little bit of that spontaneous bands that used to happen. But you know, you might get it back someday.
Yeah. Well, Mac, I certainly thank you.
Okay, I hope I've got someone there to help you.